You are listening to a podcast by the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. The NSVRC serves as the nation's principal information and resource center regarding all aspects of sexual violence and its prevention. This podcast is a recording of keynote speaker Rebecca Stevens at the 2011 National Sexual Assault Conference.
At this time, I'd like to introduce Becca Stevens, who is an entrepreneur, a speaker, and an author of 8 books. Becca is a Nashvillian, which I actually think is great because she actually has received numerous awards. Not just was she named Nashvillian of the Year, but she was also named Tennessean of the Year. So I think it's pretty safe to say that Nashville, Tennessee loves their own Becca Stevens. Becca Stevens is the founder of Magdalene House, which serves in a residential community for women who have survived lives of violence, prostitution, and addiction. She's also the executive director of its social enterprise, Thistle Farm. Hopefully many of you have been outside, just right outside the front doors there of the ballroom to see their display and to see their nice packages out there. And if you haven't, I'm sure after Becca finishes that you all will be going out there to check out the Thistle Farm's display. And at this time, I'd like to introduce Becca to the stage.
I feel like I'm preaching at a church and nobody's going to be in the front. I promise I'm not taking up an offering. Not till afterwards when we invite you to go back to the Thistle Farms table, that is. I am so humbled to be here and so grateful. And I've thought a lot about what it is I wanted to share this morning with you. What do you want to do? Oh. And what I was thinking and what was humbling about it is that this is really more than just preaching to the choir. And you have to be careful what you say in front of such beautiful voices. I didn't want to come and just talk about the macro stats that we all know so well that we face in this big world. Didn't want to talk just about the idea of what our political hurdles and obstacles are that we face all the time. And I definitely didn't want to stick to just universal truths. It would be a disservice to both of us to stay on that plane of conversation on the last day of the conference, when it's a time to be inspired and a turning out back to the world. If anything, the very last keynote is kind of a benediction, of a sending out, about reminding us what it means to leave this place and hop on a boat a little bit farther down the river of justice, and to imagine for a minute how it is really possible for us to love the whole world a person at a time. How is that possible? And so I wanted to begin today with sharing with you just one story. One story that represents a lot of stories of the women that I've been privileged to serve for the last 15 years at Magdalene. It started as one house, one community, just a place to be a sanctuary separate from political systems, religious systems, prison systems, all of it. Just a place to invite 5 women to come and stay free for 2 years with no authority living in the house to establish community. The women that we serve on average are first sexually abused, raped, between the ages of 7 and 11. The women on average have been on the streets for years. Some of them have up to 250 arrests on their record. So the idea was to create a safe and long-term community where there was enough space that you could actually breathe and begin to go back far enough to do some healing. When the first 5 women came and everyone stayed, they were off the streets and clean and sober. We opened up another house and another house. About 150 women have graduated the 2-year program. We have 6 houses at this time. 72% of the women who come into Magdalene are clean and sober 2.5 years after they come. It has been an amazing community that has changed my life, changed the way that I think and move in this world. And it does inspire me to go back out and try to love it again and again and again. And so I want to introduce you to Sheila, one of the many women that I love being around and get to be with almost every day of my life. And here's Sheila's story.
The mouse is not there.
And so I can't really say I was raised anywhere because I've been all over. I just say I'm from Nashville. I'm not one to share my story too much. I'm just starting on it. I was born in Welch, West Virginia, but we left there when I was 6 weeks old. She left my dad and met this guy and ran away with the carnival. And so can't really say I was raised anywhere because I've been all over. I just say I'm from Nashville now because I made this my home. This is my first place that I could call home. We'll just put it like that. I'd say I'm from a very, very dysfunctional family, okay? My mom was an alcoholic. At the age of 6, I started getting molested from whoever she would bring home. The only good memories of my childhood is whenever I got to go stay with my grandma and my grandpa. I think one of the most traumatic things that happened to me in my childhood, and to me this was worse than going through the molestation and dealing with all of that, is I had a sister. Her name was Michelle, okay? And my mom had left me and Michelle in Philadelphia. I mean, she left us with pretty much complete strangers. And Michelle's father had found out that my mom had left us there. And so he would come every weekend and pick me and Michelle up and take us to New York to his family's house. And then one weekend, he came and picked Michelle up. And then I never seen her again. She was 7 whenever he got her. I was 9. I had to do what I had to do to take care of myself. I was in and out of jail. From there, I went to Memphis. And that's when my world turned upside down. I met a pimp, and he sold me a dream. And he gave me dope, okay? And then one day, I owed him. And then that's where I became a real live prostitute. I've been cross-country. I've been arrested in about 25 different states for prostitution. He brought me to Nashville back in 96, and I left. And I've been on my own since then. A trick told me about Magdalene. It took me going to jail and getting my time put into effect for me to sit. And about 75 days into my sentence, I was thinking, God, you know, I only got 4 more months in jail, and whenever I get out, I'm just going to go back to doing the same thing. So I might as well try to get some help. And so I kept on writing the judge a letter telling him about the Magdalene program, and would he please give me the opportunity to come to it. I was just so over being out there, you know, so over it. So over it. It's really degrading. You know, I've had a lot of bad, bad stuff happen to me. I've been duct taped, tied up, kicked out in the Salt Lake City Canyon. I've been raped I don't know how many different times in some inhumane ways, you know. I've had a lot of bad stuff happen to me out there. I had to do something different, you know. But when I got to the Magdalene program, it was a beautiful thing, you know. I went in and everyone is just so loving and stuff like that. Needless to say, I didn't have no clothes or anything like that. I lost everything. And a few of the women gave me some pants and some shoes and stuff. And it was a good experience. And now I'm a recovering addict, okay? See, so I can understand a little bit about what my mom was going through. Because, see, when you're young, you don't see all that stuff. You don't know that your mom is an alcoholic and that she's addicted to dope. But you don't know all that stuff. All you know is that that's what she's doing to you. I have a beautiful relationship with my mom now. I had always looked for her, but they had her believing that we died in a car accident. The first time I seen her was when I was in the Magdalene program. Her and my mom came for Christmas, my first Christmas at Magdalene. I got to see my sister. Yeah, it was awesome. Most people call that a bad thing. But that ended up being a really good thing for me. My vanity was real bad, okay? I had this long, pretty hair, you know? Never left home without makeup, okay? I always had to be dressed cute and stuff. And that cancer broke me down. Oh, yeah. That chemotherapy broke me down. It made me get a relationship with myself and get with the real me. And I went completely bald-headed, you know. And I went and spent all kinds of money on these wigs and stuff. But, you know, I ended up getting with me, and I didn't wear the wigs. I just throw a bandana around my head and be done with it. Now I don't wear makeup. I just, you know, it made me comfortable with me. It's the best thing that ever happened to me. Breast cancer was a survivor. Now. Hey, I am a survivor. All kinds of different things. I think it was a God thing, you know, that I landed a job, and I've never had to leave my foundation because Magdalene is my foundation. and I got a passion for it. I love the women. I own my own home. I'm a homeowner, which I got my house through the Magdalene program. Married, got my kids. I got a job that I love, you know. And my life is beautiful now. It is beautiful. Love my life. I wouldn't give it up for nothing. Wouldn't trade it for nothing. Wouldn't pick up no piece of dope for nothing. It is beautiful. It's about time I start giving back as far as this goes, you know. It's important that people know that they can do it too.
So after working in the communities about 5 years, it really dawned on me that while women were doing amazing healing, climbing Mount Everest of healing on their bodies and minds and spirits, they were still poor as dirt. We were having a lot of trouble getting people economically independent. And it's pretty shallow to talk about trying to love each other well and be about healing if you're not concerned about people's economic well-being in the process of that. So the idea of Thistle Farms was born. And we named it Thistle Farms because of that beautiful weed that was growing out on the streets and in the abandoned places where the women were walking and sleeping in alleys, and the idea of farms being something growing. And thistles are known as a noxious weed. They have the longest taproot of about any wildflower or weed, depending on your perspective out there. And they have the most beautiful purple center. They're rich and glorious, and they have all kinds of uses. So we started Thistle Farms, and we thought it was a really cute and interesting name. We went for years, and we never really made any bath and body cares out of the thistle. And then we decided we should start really trying to make use of it, that it shouldn't just be an idea, that it should be practical. So in addition to all the bath and body care products we started making, we started harvesting thistle and making paper and folding them into boxes and putting oils in them and all kinds of really good stuff. And so then we decided we better really research the thistle some more. So I started looking online, and I found that for about 1,000 years, the people have been using thistle and the extract from thistle to restore and detoxify the liver. And so we have been out there for about 1.5 years, maybe by that time, picking thistle, getting thistle all over us, putting it in a slurry with water and having it drip on us, pressing it into paper, all the while not knowing that we had by accident picked the one weed in the world that was about the healing of the people that we were serving. It continues to be like that. That what we're finding on this path as we keep going forward is not new ground, but old ground that's firm and solid that we can stand on. When we built our last house, we went and spoke at an assembly ground up in the hills of Tennessee. And we spoke about the work and the women and about our desire to be in community and to keep moving forward, and we needed this new house, so we were raising money for it. The folks in the assembly ground gave us the money, and we walked outside, and there was a big old stone archway that had been sitting there for about 150 years that said, "Blessed is she who plucks the thistle and plants a garden." This is our old truths that we're learning about in these conferences. It's not new. Both the violence and the restoration for all of us in our lives. The truth that while the scars of violence that we have carried on our bodies stay with us, there are things that run much deeper than that. Things like gratitude, things like meaning and purpose, things like thriving in community, and things like love and forgiveness. Deep truths that carry us farther than we can imagine. So we started taking all our thistle products on the road several years ago. And in the meantime, we also started going to other communities of women who are surviving all kinds of sexual violence, who had also band together, and to see how we could cross market and how we could work together. And we went to a group in Rwanda, all survivors of the genocide, who had come together to make a cooperative called Ikirizi. And they go out every day and they farm geranium in these lush, beautiful fields. And then they make these essential oils out of the geranium. It's like liquid gold. It is good for so many healing properties. It's beautiful oil. And it also happens to be an amazing mosquito repellent. And we knew we wanted, that was the product we wanted to start with. And so we went and we are the, you know, U.S. manufacturer. What do you call it when you're the biggest person that buys something? Distributor. Not manufacturer. Distributor. We were their U.S. distributor, and we started getting the geranium oil, so we started putting it in just about anything we could find that we were making and taking it around with us. And we started making this geranium spray, this all-natural, beautiful spray. And anywhere we went, we would pack the thistle paper, the books that we have been writing together called Find Your Way Home, and I started piling the geranium in because I wanted everybody to know about this beautiful group in Rwanda doing this good work. About a year and a half ago, we started a prison tour, so we were telling the story of hope and healing and community inside the prison as well as to amazing groups of people who are doing the work. We went to a prison in Houston, Texas, and I don't know if you've been to the prison, the women's prison in Houston, Texas, but it is old school. They have no air conditioning in the prison. Houston, Texas, no air conditioning in the women's prison. Long sleeve white shirts and pants, and they work in turnip fields outside. And we came in and we brought the books so we could pass them out to everybody called Find Your Way Home that all the women of Magdalene band together and wrote. About 300 books we brought in. And they called all the women in from the fields and they came and they sat in this chapel area to hear the stories from the women and to hear about the possibility of what it means to join together in community. Well, I packed everything for that trip, and so I'd stuffed the geranium oil in with the books when I left Nashville, pulled the books out, go into prison, we start passing them out. And one of the women sitting right in the front just took the book and put it over her face and just started breathing it in. This smells so good, she said. What is it? It smells like heaven. It's like the best thing. And in that pungent and hard prison, I imagine it was. And I knew what I was witnessing, that somehow a drop of Rwandan geranium oil, harvested by a group of women who had known some of the worst violence possible in this world, had made its way to another group of women, all who had known sexual violence, and put them on a product that is labeled Love Heals. And that made its way to Houston, Texas, and through the prison walls themselves, and a drop had found its way to be a part of healing for a woman we never knew. Truly, on a scale of love, a drop is plenty in this big world. That we have no idea how all the work that we do ripples its way through and affects people we can't imagine. This work, on whatever scale, on small and big scales that we do, in small and big communities, is huge. So the call always when we come together, always when we stumble on these old truths and remind each other of them, is to keep walking towards love for all of us. To keep taking that next step and trusting that next drop of work that we have. Those drops make their way all the way around the world and back to us and fill us with hope and joy. The beautiful thing is it's not any of us doing it by ourselves. It's all of us doing it together. I think when people burn out on the work, it has something to do with thinking it's me against the world, instead of thinking it's all of us doing our best to love each other, that we can do this in community and in solidarity with each other, that we don't have to burn out. We can support each other and keep going. This is a life's work, loving the whole world a person at a time. It takes at least a lifetime, so we can't afford to burn out. We have to keep coming back together and reminding each other how good it is to be a part of this work. And that's the truth. It is such a great gift to be a part of the work of healing in people's lives. It's so great to be part of a communal vision and to share that. And the truth is that in that way, the missteps and the hurdles that all of us experience become as great a teachers as all the great successes we've known. At least in my work in the last couple decades, I've had some huge missteps. I've had some huge hurdles, and I have learned so much from them. I remember the first woman that we worked with who relapsed and went back on the streets and was murdered, Julia Basquet. She was beautiful and stunning. Her abuse started at the age of about 6 with her father. And she came and she got clean and sober. She was off the street. She was going back to school. Her mom called. She needed her back home. She went back home and the cycle started again. I was so new into being a part of the Magdalene community that I was so worried that there would be judgment about Julia and thinking that somehow I had to protect her reputation after the murder. I didn't want any of the women or supporters of Magdalene to say, well, if you work the program, it works. Well, she should just have tried harder. She did it to herself. That was my fear. And we gathered together and had a small memorial service for her. And to a woman sitting at the service, the message was, it was merciful. Merciful? That I didn't expect. For people to say to die if you can't find that healing, rather than to live in the hell on the streets for another 10 years or so, was some of the most humbling information I had ever received. That this is truly life and death work, and that if it's bad enough to say something like that, I would be about this work for the rest of my life. Several years later, a woman named Peggy Sue died. And Peggy Sue died in state custody, and she weighed about 85 pounds. And the last time I saw her, she had a feeding tube in her, and she was shackled to the bed. And when she began to talk about what it meant to not be able to come back home, I knew that this was my fear, that my fear was that it would never be enough to really be about healing, that if you have all of this pain in your life, and if you've been on the streets and you were dying of diseases in state custody, that maybe it would never be enough. She died, and we got ready to have the memorial service, and while I have done 100 funerals as a pastor, this was the one that scared me. This was about our failings as a society, as a community, as a person. And that the reality was, if you have a really, really horrible childhood and you're poor all your life and you die on the streets, there's not much hope. Shaking, we started that service. And as soon as we began, we were all silenced, weeping, standing together, weeping. And I'm telling you, love was so thick in the room, you couldn't cut it. It was probably the closest I've known, really, to what the heart of God must be like. And I thought, if this is the worst our world has to offer, this kind of horrible violence, injustice, pain, I will take it, knowing that when there is nothing else, there is love. And it is powerful enough to carry us through that even. That is good to know. There is nothing more powerful than that in the world. That we can go out with unguarded hearts and speak our truth, knowing we have nothing to fear because we have that. That is a beautiful gift. And I get to learn that over and over again, in both success and in both failure. And so do you. This past year, NPR came to Thistle Farms, 10-year anniversary of this social enterprise, now in 190 stores nationwide, that we've broken these sales barriers on social enterprise. We have 35 women working for the company now, and they did a four-day story. It was going to be our big moment. Once you get this, you'll have no worries. You'll just sell forever. So they came and they came. I don't know. They were there like 3 or 4 weeks. And we were on for them. Everybody got to work on time and nobody said any cuss words. Hey, good morning. Like that kind of thing. We were doing that. And Jackie Lydon, the correspondent, saw right through it. And she said, this is all so sunshiny. I want to talk to somebody that's relapsed. And I'm like, well, that's not my place. I mean, you know, people have a choice about when and where they tell their story. But there was a woman who graduated that was a friend and a beautiful person who had gone through a recent relapse. And I said, I'll just call her and ask her. If she wants to call you, she can. She did, and she came in and gave a powerful interview about the horrible reality of relapsing after years of being off the streets and in recovery. And the truth was, she was in a really horrible relationship, and almost always, the women who have been part of the Magdalene community relapse over relationship before they relapse over drugs or just going back out and tricking on the streets. And she told that to Jackie, and she told it in a really powerful and deep way. They go back and they get ready to edit the story and put it out there. The first time Thistle Farms really is going to be introduced to the country in this way. And about 4 days before it airs, we get a call that the woman had been arrested for murder, that she and 3 other people had been on the streets. They were rolling somebody that was a trick, and he was dead. I had been through everything on the other side of that, of seeing women who had been beaten so badly that you could not identify their bodies, of being a part of Jane Doe's that you had to identify, of women who had died on the streets, but never a participant or graduate of Magdalene who had actually killed somebody. And so the folks at Magdalene said, you have to call Jackie Lydon and tell her what happened before this airs. And I said, why? I mean, is there a moral reason or like a legal reason I have to? That was really scary. If people know that the people we hold up as victims can perpetrate too, they won't love us then. They won't buy the products then. This will be bad. This is when we'll get judgment. You have to call, they said. So I called reluctantly. Jackie said they would either pull the piece or they had to redo it and talk about the pending murder case. And I told her, too, if you do this, this will really, really cost us. And there's a lot at stake, and we've been working for 15 years. And we have worked hard and been faithful, and this is an anomaly. This doesn't happen. And this is about the truth of what real violence does. You better say that. You better talk about the long-term effects of violence on bodies. They did a brief statement at the end of the second piece after they interviewed Tara. They did the whole thing. And all that happened was that people cried with us. People cried with us and said, that is so sad. I am so sorry. I still didn't trust that the community really was with us. Us. That people really do want to hope and believe that together we can all be better and well. And that when tragedy happens, we all feel it and we don't judge, that we are learning to love in a more radical way, which is without judgment. All this work is a mystery in the end for me. It truly is. And I love it. I love that I don't understand exactly where it's heading and where it's leading all of us, except that it's leading us to be deeper into the truths that we know. So since I was so humbled thinking about speaking to this group, I want to end my time with you with a humble image. It's the image of my bathtub. I have a bathtub that looks pretty much like the bathtubs in everybody's hotel rooms here, just flat out on the ground. Mine was built in about 1940, so it has like four handles, two for the shower and two for the bathtub. And it's old, and I have retreated to that bathtub for 18 years now. I have grieved my mother in that bathtub. I have welcomed new babies and bathed them first in that bathtub. I have dreamed and imagined new programs in that bathtub. I have hidden from my family in that bathtub. That bathtub is my think tank. It is where a drop of oil is plenty. And it is no mistake that our social enterprise is a bath and body care company. It's where that idea was born. It's where I go both to retreat and inspire myself. To dream again, to have enough space to think for a minute. And all of us have those places, those special private bathtub places. Maybe it's the wood, maybe it's the woods, the chair in a house. I don't know where yours is, but I know that all of us have those places that we can go as both respite, retreat, and sanctuary. And I think it's important that we celebrate them, that we nurture them, that we put a candle there, that we dance as we're heading there with no apologies, that we're taking a moment or an hour to regroup. It is where we find our own health, too, to come alive in our work. And when our work is alive, it is thriving and growing and not burning out. It's coming to new life and inspiring us. My hope is that we all lavish them, that we get to talk to each other about them and joke about them and celebrate them. And then that all those new ideas and inspiration that comes from those places, that we let those ideas have life in this world. I think there is a space between inspiration and action. It is almost imperceptible. It is so small. What moves us all from inspiration to action? That holy and sacred step where we take an idea, a dream, a hope, a truth, and give it life. It's there in all of us that there is another step. That some idea that we've had at this conference, some place that we have been dreaming about in our private bathtubs, takes on new life. It's there that one drop of action can ripple and change the course of all of us, where we can join that old path of truth, where we step towards love and we find that we have knee-buckling gratitude, that kind of gratitude that brings you to your knees. I am so grateful that I got to do this. What a gift to me in my life to know this kind of healing, to know that I can say that love is the most powerful force for change that we have in the world. I am humbled. I am humbled to be among you and be a part of you today, this gifted and beautiful group, this gifted and beautiful group that continues to hope in this world, to work for justice and peace. So we gather and we remember to inspire each other and to be inspired ourselves, and then we turn back out into the world. That is our job, to turn back out into the world and to be a witness that those scars of violence are not the last word ever, that there are truths that run much deeper and have always carried us. Love is the most powerful force for change that we have. Thank you.
For more information on the NSVRC, please go to www.nsvrc.org or call 877-739-3895. The NSVRC was founded by the Pennsylvania Coalition Against Rape and is funded in large part by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.